Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and Jeopardy is here. Joining Jeopardy is Alex Stewart.
Good evening.
Good evening, Alex Stewart and Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Hello, Joe.
Hello, Seb. How are you?
I'm very well. Very well.
It's a good day, wasn't it?
We had fun. Today the football's gripping. You spent some time with the wall chart. You enjoyed that. Yeah. You got into it.
Can I say this morning when I looked at the fixtures...
You were not happy.
I thought, heh. I thought yesterday was so much fun. This day looks rubbish. And it wasn't. I mean, one of the games was a bit boring. But the other two were good.
No, I don't even think the first game was that boring. I think it was...
I missed it, almost all of it.
Yeah, so it was...
it was tense.
It wasn't high quality, but it was tense and it was interesting and it had a really good goal in it. We got a good day of football, which I feel like is sort of a... That's kind of what happens, isn't it? You look at a tournament and it's scheduled and you plot your good days.
Mm.
And the good days kind of let you down. Today didn't, though. So.
No. Do you know where else it's a good football day every day?
No.
The Athletic. If you visit theathletic.com/TIFOFootball, you'll find that there'll be a great deal available to you there. I don't know what it is, but it will be really good. There'll be some kind of introductory offer or perhaps even a free trial. You can try it out and read some of the finest football writers in the world. Alex Stewart, who's your favourite football writer for The Athletic?
I like them all.
Just one name, though.
James Horncastle.
Horncastle's a nice guy. What about you, Seb?
Danny Taylor.
Big names. Big names on the Danny leaf. Yeah. So if you visit theathletic.com/TIFO, you'll find a fantastic deal and you can join us at The Athletic where they do stuff which is a lot higher quality than the stuff that we do here. Anyway, that's all for us for the intro and I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of the Euros. Let's begin with Jeopardy, of course. But also, I would say the height of Jeopardy for today, Seb, was Wales versus Turkey. It was actually exciting. It was actually nerve-biting. There were stakes. It mattered. And I loved it. And I want you to begin with Bale because he had a brilliant performance, penalty miss aside, which I think we can probably explain from looking at it.
Yeah.
But the most interesting thing about his performance today, beyond how great it was very different from what we expect from him, the mark of a great player.
I think so. Mark of a great player being that as time goes on and some of your attributes fade away, you can adjust and still be just as influential within a game. And Bale still is quick. He hasn't turned into a kind of, a slow player or someone that can't beat a man. But now you're seeing the kind of the creativity and the technical prowess in his passing, which is fascinating because it's something that...
Is it a hashtag reinvention?
I don't know about reinvention. It seems more like it's an ability that's developed over time, yes, but something which he hasn't necessarily been encouraged to do because his other attributes were so strong. So if you have Gareth Bale on the ball, you want him probably taking a player on, probably driving in field and getting the ball on his left foot. Still can do that.
Am I wrong to say he was kind of doing Harry Kane things today?
A little bit deeper and probably without sort of, yes, Kane comes quite deep, but then as soon as he lays the ball off, he's heading for the penalty box. Bale didn't do that so much. He was happy to kind of pick the ball up maybe 40 yards away from goal and see what was going on ahead of him. And you kind of saw him playing as a number 10. He's got, people who watch Tottenham this season will have seen this a few times. He's got a really nice raking pass, really nice sort of lofted, feathered touch that kind of can drift the ball in above over the top of a defence and drop it in behind. And you're seeing this sort of, I don't know, it's funny because there's a very strange narrative around him. There's a little bit of a question mark about whether he's going to play club football again.
Yeah.
If he does, where? And so it's almost like a free hit, isn't it? We don't have a kind of, there's no conversation about what Gareth Bale does as a player next. It's all about Wales for once. It doesn't involve, what is his dedication to his national team? How does that compare to his commitment to Real Madrid? That stuff, all on ice. And you're just seeing what a good technical footballer is. And in a really pure way, with his passing and his creativity. It's lovely.
Do you know how we were talking about Alvaro Morata the other day and saying that it feels a bit like he's priced himself out of a club that would actually suit his ability? Yeah. Do you think with Bale, like one of the issues is, obviously he played at Tottenham for this season and wasn't really getting much game time at Real Madrid the season before that. Do you think it's possible that within the teams that he plays in, there's always going to be somebody who has either been purchased to do exactly what he was doing today or somebody better or more natural at doing what he was doing today, and therefore he's never going to get the opportunity to do that at club level for two reasons. there's already someone else in his team, and there's not going to be a team that could afford him or afford to pay him to play in that way, presumably, right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because I think that at this point in his career, if he does go and play another season away from Real Madrid, it's going to be on loan.
Mm-hmm.
It's also going to be a place where, because that would be a short-term move, you wouldn't necessarily be comfortable building a side around him, which is what that player kind of wants.
Yeah.
The one place where Bale's been a constant is for Wales.
Mm-hmm.
And so you feel comfortable allowing players to come into the international setup, grow used to what he can do. Whereas at club level, I think sort of directors of football or coaches, they want Bale for the kind of the more literal side of his game, the kind of the side that made him famous and made him a European Cup winner.
Yeah.
You want Bale as not a winger anymore, but probably as a number nine almost, is like you want his finishing ability. So go and stand in the box and, you know, don't drift too far, because we're not gonna bring in five or six new players and orbit them around you, because that's ridiculous for a loanee. So it's really interesting. It's fun as well. I like Gareth Bale. I've loved watching him for a very, very long time. And I've always loved the way he plays for his country, what it means to him, the enthusiasm he has for it. Because sometimes it goes either one of two ways with players of that standing in the game. When they play for nations who aren't amongst the very best in the world, they either come to international duty with a slight reluctance, or they absolutely love it. They prefer it to club football. And Bale is the latter. And I think that's endearing, is a little patronizing, but it's affecting. It's really
jeopardy.
Nice.
It's jeopardy. It creates jeopardy. Alex, there was a moment in the, I think it was in the first half, when Bale had a bit of space ahead of him, and it was a 1v1 with him and Soyuncu. They were both running back towards Turkey's goal, and he got tackled fairly easily. And you saw the change in him from the player that he was. You know, at the time we were joking about how Maicon would be sitting at home and watching and saying, you know, time catches up with everyone, right? But actually it felt like, and I'm sure this is just me placing a narrative on top of the game, I'm sure he was doing the playmaker stuff beforehand, but it felt like that was the moment where he stopped trying to run past people with the ball and he started making these extremely effective passes.
Yeah, there was one earlier pass for the Ramsey attempt, which was saved really well down low to the goalkeeper's right with his foot. And that was a very cute kind of outside of the foot pass from the left half space. But generally speaking, it did feel like that was the point at which Bale thought, yeah, running past people is maybe not the way to go now. And I think what Wales did really effectively throughout was create rotations in midfield. So Morel, who we'll talk about a little bit later, I think, kind of sat and anchored a little bit, but ahead of him, there was an awful lot of up and down vertical movement. And Bale was dropping off and tucking inside. So the pass that he played for Ramsey's goal, which was an absolutely sumptuous curving ball over the top, which Ramsey anticipated perfectly, that came from him being in really quite a withdrawn, almost a sort of James Rodriguez assist. Yeah. It was that sort of movement off the flank, turning onto your stronger foot and curving the ball around. And I think Bale, you know, it's interesting. I recall us talking before about this idea that when players perhaps lose some of their physical ability, lose a yard of pace, the really good ones do adapt because they have technical proficiency as well. And that side of the game almost becomes unovershadowed, if that's not a horribly cumbersome phrase. But Bale's not had consistent club football in order to have the time to do this. Like when Ronaldo reinvented himself as more of a kind of penalty box predator, he was still playing very, very regularly. So he had the time to become a different player. And Bale hasn't really been afforded that. So you feel like he's almost feeling his way through that process in games that we're watching.
Yeah.
And that's why your point about him trying to run Soyuncu and failing, it did feel like a kind of, oh, I'm going to have to adapt here and now. And he did it brilliantly.
Turns out he's really good. So it helps, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It helps if you're really good at stuff. Someone else who's really good, or at least did a really good thing, was Aaron Ramsey, who scored a super goal. Alex, tell me about the goal.
It was just that movement. I mean, so with Wales, right, they've got Kiefer Moore up front. And I had anticipated with Wales going into this tournament that they would persist with Harry Wilson up front. They were making some really nice combinations with a fluid forward line.
He was in the false nine, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's the sort of role that he plays. And Moore had been very successful in qualifying, but in the sort of two or three games prior to the tournament starting, they'd been chopping and changing a bit. Moore's come back in, and what he does superbly well is hold the ball up.
Mm.
And when you've got Ramsey playing as a 10 behind him, Ramsey will come deep and he'll spray the ball around and he'll pass it a lot. But he absolutely excels at these bursting runs past. And when you have a focal point, you know, you can achieve it with two ways. You can have a player dropping off and creating that space by pulling players with him, or you can just have a player who's big and strong enough to hold up the ball, flick things over, or make defenders worry. And all of the Turkish defense was focused on what Kiefer Moore was doing, who had his back to goal and wasn't going anywhere. But he'd given them such problems prior to that point that Ramsey's run just wasn't noticed.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bale's pass obviously was as good as it was and found him in space. But I think Wales have got this really effective combination of, you know, wide players with pace, well, lots of pace in Dan James, lots of end product in Bale. But this kind of 1-2 relationship between Ramsey and Kiefer Moore is going to be great against teams who can't track runners or who worry about the size and the physicality of a target man.
Well, I want to come back to that because I know you've got some thoughts about how they could cause Italy some damage, potentially. We'll talk about that. But Seb, I wanted to say there was a nice moment after Ramsey scored, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was. He scored his goal and he ran across the running track at in Baku and he found Chris Gunter, who was the best man at his wedding. It's kind of nice, isn't it? Miles and miles and miles from home, right at the top of the game, European Championship, get to celebrate a goal like that with one of your best friends. That's really cool. I like
Sure. Football, the thing of moments that are nice. Anyway, there was also lovely stuff at the back, wasn't there, Seb? Some nice near-post defending that you noticed from Wales.
Yeah, I'm going to play the hits for the chat group because I thought Joe Roden was really good.
Roden!
So the first time I ever saw him, I went to the Liberty Stadium to watch Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds United. Bielsa had been there for probably a month or two by then. And I went to see Leeds. And Roden really stood out because he was this elegant player on the ball in a division which isn't necessarily known for breeding kind of cultured defenders. And it's kind of stuck in my mind that he's a finesse player ever since. And he's spent a bit of time at Tottenham, hasn't really played as much as I'd have hoped. But you haven't really seen him under any kind of physical duress. And so what I thought was really impressive tonight is Turkey's kind of internal central networks weren't really working. Like Çalhanoğlu wasn't really in the right position, so a lot of their football went out wide.
Sounds like you're talking about city planning or something.
Yeah, it's kind of a SimCity situation. Yeah, when you build your little grids. A lot of Turkish football went out wide and they arrowed a lot of crosses. They're kind of shelling the Welsh penalty boxes. And Roden was great. And Roden was great under a little bit of a physical bombardment. Obviously, Barrett Yilmaz in open play, but at defensive set pieces, that Welsh centre-back pairing and Ben Davis in there as well, because he won a few crucial headers. Mm-hmm. It really stood up to the challenge, and it was...
They stood up to Big Bad Bulmer.
Oh, you missed it.
I missed it.
Big Bad Burak. Yeah. It was interesting because it showed me a side of Joe Roden I haven't really seen before. I know all about what he can do on the ball and that he can pass and carry the ball a little bit, but to be kind of old-fashioned and resilient, yeah, it was impressive.
He has a sort of mechanical side to him, doesn't he? Roden. Alex, also, Joe Morrell was a player that you were particularly impressed with for his crucial clearances.
Yeah, he made some good clearances. He was Wales's deepest midfielder most of the time, although I thought Wales' defensive organisation was excellent. And, rightly, kudos to Roden and also Meppham for his clearances. But I think what Morrell did really, really well was when Wales did... managed to get some possession and initially it was a little bit, you know, I think it finished relatively well split on possession, but they weren't massively getting their foot on the ball. And Morrell's ability to move out of the cover shadow, make sure that he was the link between the solidity of the Welsh defence and then the exciting attacking options, I thought was really, really impressive. And I'll be honest, he was not a player that I had come across at all prior to this.
Is he the player who plays at Luton?
He plays at Luton, yeah. So for him to step up, because there's a contrast here. So Turkey's left back plays for Le Havre in Ligue 2, and he's clearly like Turkey's weakest player, I think, you know, and it was possible to target him. He got very few crosses in. Morel is playing at a level that is considerably higher than any level he's played before, but he doesn't look out of place at all.
It's nice.
And I think that says a lot about obviously his ability as a footballer, but also his character, that he's not thinking, you know, oh. And I do wonder whether this point that you were making earlier, Seb, about people like Bale and Ramsey clearly, you know, playing elite club careers, but loving playing international football and creating this sense of harmony and togetherness within a squad, that it allows those other players that are less experienced to feel much more comfortable in that environment. I think that might be really important.
Because it could be so difficult for someone like that. Yeah. You come from the Championship. Bale has won 4 European Cups. Aaron Ramsey's been at the top of the game for a really long time and, you know, comes from a place where, which is very, very different to the Championship. And obviously, if you've been at Luton Town, you've also been in League One quite recently. And that's a real credit to the professionalism of those players. Because it does come down to atmosphere. How many times, for instance, have you heard a story, like a long read, which is about an unsuccessful tournament performance centered around bad atmosphere? People were bored. There were cliques. There were unhappy players who were missing their homes and their families and stuff. So if you allow people to be accepted and you allow people to become part of a group, you're going to get a better football team. I know it's not the most important thing, but it's a great starting point.
Yeah.
I wonder whether for Ramsey it's more a case of, certainly it's for Bale because of his time at Real Madrid, because he didn't play very much. But Ramsey's been a little bit peripheral at Juventus. It must be nice to come back to a place where he isn't permanently on trial, where there isn't a kind of debate about his worth and his salary. It's just he's one of our most important players, you're starting. And that must be great. That must be so reassuring for a player.
I also wonder whether, obviously, Rob Page has stepped into the head coach role slightly precipitously and was the assistant coach prior to doing so. And I think clearly is doing a really, really good job.
Evidently so, yeah.
But the assistant coaches are usually tasked with having a more close and personal relationship with players, whereas managers kind of stand off a little bit. I wonder whether going into a tournament with your head coach having recently been the person with whom you had those more personal conversations and who was maybe a bit more hands-on in training and so on, again, just creates a greater degree of harmony and makes people feel comfortable.
Unity, maybe.
Yeah, exactly this, yeah.
I always thought it can go one of two ways though, isn't it? Like in this case, absolutely, I think you're spot on. But it's one or the other, isn't it? Either you don't, as an assistant, you're a little bit too matey with the players. And so when it comes to actually coaching the team and disciplining and dropping, like there are a lot of stories about assistants finding it very difficult to step up and take and assume those duties. But this seems perfect. This seems very together.
I have to say, I agree. I think if either of you stepped up to be in charge of TIFO, Don and Sol would run riot.
They wouldn't accept authority. They barely do at the moment, to be fair.
They're just hanging on a knife edge. It really is. Wales desperately needed this victory, right? Yeah. Having lost the first game to Switzerland, who obviously lost tonight to Italy. We'll come to talk about that as well.
Well, drew with Switzerland. Drew with Switzerland, though. 1-1 draw.
Was it?
Sure was.
Oh, I'm thinking of Scotland who lost.
You are, yeah.
Oh, Wales got four points.
You've got your home nations mixed up there.
Wales got 4 points.
Mm-hmm. Is that because you're just insular in English and you're arrogant and you just think no other place
it
exists?
It must be.
Be a little bit like that.
Yeah. Well, so they're through, aren't they?
Pretty much.
No one doesn't go through with 4 points.
It would take something very unlikely for Wales not to go through now. Yeah. So as long as they don't take an absolute battering from an Italian side who are already through, definitely already through, then they will be playing in the last 16. That's rattled you because
week. I was about to launch into something that was completely
launch into anyway, and let's see what it might have been like. Yeah.
Wales really needed this win. I mean, that's still technically true because if they'd lost, they would have been looking for something from Italy. I mean, the point stands because their final game is against Italy, right? And I suppose it almost doesn't really matter what happens now. Mm-hmm. I suppose the only potential downside is that Switzerland could beat Turkey, finish on 4.2, have a better goal difference. But I think I struggle to see any third place team with 4 points not going through at this point.
Yeah, I agree. And also because we covered this last night, as long as the first round may be and as many games it involves, there aren't many teams that get eliminated.
Yeah.
You get to 4 points, you're kind of safe because you'll see teams get through on 3 points, I promise you. So yeah, and obviously only eight are leaving. So
yeah,
maybe 1 point you're out, 2 points you're probably out, 4 you're going to go through. So it'll be okay.
Okay, well, in which case, there's only one thing we wanted to touch on with Turkey, who I suppose we can talk a bit more about for the next game against Switzerland. It's a very, very big one. But it was a statistic that we debated over during the game about Soyuncu, Seb.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So this conversation started as you saying something, Joe, and me kind of dismissing you, being like, oh, shut up.
That's right. That is what happened. Right. Mm-hmm.
So apparently, Soyuncu recorded the quickest, the sixth quickest sprinting speed in the Premier League last season.
Yeah.
Behind
Cole. He reached the sixth top speed.
Yeah. There isn't an elegant way of expressing that.
I just expressed it pretty elegantly.
Yeah,
but sure.
You did all right. Okay. But so he finished behind Kyle Walker, Adama Traore, Mason Greenwood, Aston Villa's Trezeguet, and Aaron Wan-Bissaka, which he just doesn't look like he should be able to move that quickly because he's like a big vending machine, isn't he?
Yeah.
With a ponytail. But
that's
big vending
true.
Machine.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know, maybe it's you know, big vending machine rolls down the hill, it kind of picks up speed, I guess. But
I'm not thinking about Wan-Bissaka. I assume he's only had the opportunity to reach that speed because he's often too far back and then he needs to make up the
then
pace.
Then he's making up the ground and he's bombing forward to provide the overlap, maybe.
The question is, when did Soyuncu record that speed? What was the scenario in the game where that happened? I mean, he must have been chasing back with the striker.
Well, this is it. Like, I feel like for a centre-back, this appearing on this list is kind of damning because it means that you've been caught out of position, you're trying to cover for it, and you're busting your gut to get back into position or cover for somebody else's mistake.
Mm.
So it must be a symptom of something going wrong somewhere.
Yeah.
But even so, Soyuncu quicker than we thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in that case, we'll come back to talk about the Wales-Italy game. And we can hear from Alex after we've talked about Italy-Switzerland. We'll be back after this.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
Italy 3-0 Switzerland. Seb, the other day we were saying Italy had never scored 3 goals in a European Championship, and now they've done it twice in the space of however many days was between those games. They were good, weren't they?
Yeah, that feels like 50% of it. They were great, they were fun. They had an awful lot of space and joy in midfield. Like every time I looked up, or every time a move broke down in their half, it seemed very easy for them to kind of transition straight through down the middle of the pitch. And how often did they find themselves either 3-on-3, 4-on-3, 4-on-4 with those inside forwards kind of like racing into space outside the defense? It's amazing how often that happened.
Yeah.
It made for a really fun watch and we certainly enjoyed it. But I thought Switzerland were absolutely dismal, particularly in midfield. I thought they were dreadful. Really disappointing because I associate them with being a bit stodgy and resilient and, you know, as a basic, as a first level.
Yeah, it's Switzerland and Sweden. They're always
they,
defensive.
They were none of those things. They were really poor.
Yeah,
really
I mean, poor. They made it, I don't know whether to say, Alex, what do you think? Did they make Italy look good with those fantastic vertical passes that seemed to cut through the entire midfield, or were Italy good? Bit of both?
I think it's a bit of both because
you shouldn't be able to pass the ball like that through any football team.
I would agree with this.
Apart from the very worst.
Apart from bad football teams.
Yeah, bad ones.
Some of them are bad. But yes, I mean, it's weird because we associate Switzerland with being kind of stolid and, you know, like purposefully irritable and hard to break down and not fun and exciting. And this Switzerland isn't fun and exciting either, but it's also kind of porous.
It has Jen Shaqiri.
It has Jadon Shaqiri, who is able to try and do things, but the lack of support, Seferovic playing up front is never going to give you a great deal because he doesn't really seem to move either. Like, he can't finish, but he's not exactly dragging defenders. Maybe the defenders just look at it and go, well, he's not going to score anyway, so why bother? But I think the problem was that Switzerland's midfield was sort of trying to, like, Freuler was trying to push up, trying to get into support a little bit. Xhaka was dropping back and trying to allow this progressive passing out to the wing backs. So, because Ricardo Rodriguez looked like the only player who was going to make something happen for Switzerland in terms of getting forwards. And so him to Xhaka, and then Xhaka either passing it short to him or trying to hit that channel and drag Bonucci or Chiellini over to it. That was what made sense for Switzerland to do. But what it did was it created this stretched situation in their midfield that Italy, when they then got the ball, were like, well, there's no one there. We can just hit it straight through. And if you've got passes of the quality of Jorginho and Locatelli in that position, plus you've got that rapid front three and Barella pushing forward to support, that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. Can I say on a slightly different note that Jadon Sancho looks like someone who lives on a planet that has a lot more gravity than he's very compact, isn't he?
His thighs are like,
it looks like someone's pressed down on his head and it's come out a bit here.
Yeah,
but like in an attractive way. I'm not saying he's unattractive or weird looking. He just looks like a man who, as I said, lives on a planet with a lot more gravity than Earth.
Yeah,
he also looks well beyond his best now. It feels like not playing.
Do you mean as a footballer or as a physical player?
As a man, no. I mean as a footballer, because it seems like not playing at Liverpool has kind of taken its toll on him.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
He's fun and sparky. He should be playing somewhere.
He's really gifted. It's really fun to see him on the ball. And he's a thrilling player, as proven in the last European Championship.
He thrills.
I just feel like what was going on behind him wasn't good enough tonight. And
same for Braylon Bolo, right? Because he thrilled the other day. And
completely different caliber of opposition.
Very few carries.
It just didn't. The don't like it football didn't really work on Italy. So
okay, well, speaking of like it football, though, Alex, tell me about the goal that was made in Sassuolo and what that means.
So Locatelli and Berardi both pay for Sassuolo. We did a video on them a while back looking at De Zerbi's tactics. What De Zerbi likes to do is empower his players to make their own decisions and play quite high-risk passes. And so that pass from Locatelli out to Berardi was a relatively low percentage pass, but it was beautifully executed. And then you've got this ability of Locatelli, which I kind of hadn't seen an awful lot from him before. Like when he does possess the ability to shoot from sort of deepish, but generally speaking, when Locatelli scores goals, it's because the ball breaks to him at the edge of the box. But this kind of steaming up in a proper box-to-box way and finishing a long move like that is something that is not necessarily what you'd associate with him.
Everyone arrived at the right time for everything in that goal. I thought that was the nice that was made. That's what made it look so nice. It was like completing itself throughout the move.
It was the sort of move that if it had been a set piece, you would have gone, oh, that was worked on the training ground.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it just clicked perfectly. Mm-hmm. And there is a real degree of understanding with this Italian team. And we've talked about this the last time we talked about Italy, how they have been revamped considerably from the squad. I can't remember how many games ago it was that we looked at it and it was Donnarumma had survived and Jorginho had survived. But
that was actually from the last game they lost.
Right. So
that was back in 2018.
Quite a while ago now.
2019, 2018. It's a long time ago.
Yeah, it's like in the last 10 games, they've scored 31 goals and they haven't conceded. Yeah. And the team hasn't changed a great deal within that period. It just feels like Verratti probably would be playing if he were fit, but...
That's an interesting thing, though, like with Verratti, because Verratti would have been starting instead of Locatelli in this tournament. If Verratti is fit and available, presumably he'll get some minutes in this third game because it's kind of a dead rubber for Italy. That's a bit of a decision because he's so gifted. How do you say to someone like that, I don't know, like how do you... It's a difficult position for Mancini to win, is what I'm saying, because Locatelli's coming, he's brilliant. He looks like the perfect sort of component for this system, as evidenced by the first goal, arguably also for the second, although Swiss defending was just dismal for that. It's hard to drop a player. It's really difficult now.
I think if anyone, actually, it's Jorginho that's vulnerable in that, because Locatelli can play at the base of a midfield three, the passing range is there. The physicality to protect the back four is arguably better than Jorginho. He offers less of that. And in fact, you actually would see, I mean, the Italian midfield is really fluid, right? But there were a number of occasions where it was Locatelli that was dropping back to be the guy that collects the ball off the defence and then shuttles it forward. And Jorginho was actually pushing higher up. So I could see whether Verratti comes in into the centre or whether you keep Verratti as one of the side players. So you get that slight Metsala thing of being able to push into the half spaces and Locatelli anchors. It's hard to know. If I were Roberto Mancini, I would have better hair for a start. But if I, you know, I wouldn't upset the balance of a team that's playing this well, even for someone as talented as Verratti.
I wonder, I mean...
Hold on a second. Should we not acknowledge the rare moment? Better hair. He's got wonderful hair.
That's what he means, though.
That's what I mean.
Oh.
If he were Roberto Mancini, he would have Roberto Mancini's hair, and that is...
Just carry on without me.
All I was going to say is that we don't know at this point because I haven't heard any more about it, but Chiellini limps off with what looked like a hamstring injury, which, if so, done for the tournament.
Well, he was straight away... He didn't even go down. It was, I'm taking off the armband, I'm off.
He also, like, once he was on the bench, it was kind of, there wasn't much recovery going on. He was like a step away from like having a beer because tournament over, it's the summer, you know. I just wonder, because Acerbi is going to probably take his place. He obviously came on for him tonight. I wonder if there has to be a little bit more defensive deference as a result, a little bit more protection, because Acerbi is nowhere near what Chiellini is.
Acerbi.
Good player, not Chiellini good. Even at this stage of his career. And so you think, right, when Italy are on the front foot, terrific. When they're not, because what we haven't seen yet is a proper examination of that unit and that goalkeeper. So that's something to watch, I guess, as the tournament goes on. Yeah. Bit of jeopardy, sort of.
Maybe. Nice bit of jeopardy.
Nice bit of jeopardy.
Terry Woodward in the chat says, did Joe stop and get off his horse? No, Joe rode on. Thank you, Terry Woodward, for that. Very nice. Very nice.
We should have all just sat in silence as that happened.
We should have done.
I did.
Alex, big game to come. Well, I suppose it depends how you look at it. Which is the bigger game then? Is it Wales, Italy, perhaps more exciting, or Switzerland, Turkey? Huge game.
Well, it's got to be Switzerland, Turkey in terms of what happens.
Progression.
But, you know, goal difference wise, Switzerland are on -3, Turkey are on -5.
Mm-hmm.
It's looking pretty bad for both of them. So unless there's an emphatic win by one of those two teams, and...
Well, I guess if Switzerland have 1 point and they win the game, 4 should probably be enough to see them go through, right? But Turkey would need to win by a number of goals, you would think, based
on... And they would need other things to happen in their favour, I think.
Yeah. And neither of... I mean, both of those teams have been pretty weak defensively.
Mm-hmm.
But they've also been pretty lacklustre going forwards. I mean...
Could be a really classic football match.
I think it'll be terrible.
Yeah.
I think it'll be incredibly dull, and it'll be settled when Soyuncu rashly brings down Mbolo for a penalty.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Okay. Good to know.
Yeah.
But we have been talking a bit over the past couple of days about the prospect of Wales facing Italy. You think there's not that this will be the outcome, but there are ways for Wales to cause Italy some issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, like Seb says, about Acerbi coming in, whether or not that's going to make a difference, if the midfield balance in front of it is affected by Verratti coming back again. So there are some, you know, imponderables here, but particularly on the left-hand side, Spinazzola, who I think has excelled so far this tournament.
It's been brilliant.
The one thing that's not really had to happen a great deal is to have him tested defensively. Which is great because he's basically playing like a winger. However, if you're Wales and you've got, you know, Gareth Bale on that side, potentially with someone like Ramsey running into the channel behind, or maybe even they play Dan James on that side and try and get that pace in behind. I think Wales' ability to spring runners from deep with that big target man who's going to cause anybody problems, even people like Bonucci, you can just see, I mean, a lot of teams this tournament have done well or badly based on how well they either exploit the defense behind the opposition's fullbacks or wingbacks, or how well they defend that space. And Italy are pretty gung-ho in this respect. And because they have the quality they do, that's been fine so far. But it'll be interesting to see how much Wales can test that, because I don't think Wales will win, but I think there will be other teams looking at that, just like they will have looked at Portugal's build-up problems or France's issues with defensive shape and gone, okay, maybe no one is completely unbeatable here.
I don't think they face an Italy team which in any way resembles this one. I think you're going to see like Blotti and Bernardeschi and Bastone in that team. Emerson probably starts at fullback. Just because of the season we've had, like you've got to look after these players, and you've got to, if you're through, you're gonna sit out this game if you can. I would have thought.
Yeah,
maybe.
I'm just looking at the wall chart to see if they were to finish second in the group, who they would play. But the wall chart's too small on my computer, so I can't tell you that. What the wall chart did tell me earlier, though,
you were not happy about this.
No, this is a different thing. Okay, we'll come to the thing I wasn't happy about. What the wall chart did tell me earlier was that Italy's most likely opponent in the quarterfinals, were both teams to finish first in their group and win their respective round of 16 ties, is Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, Alex, what you think about Italy's chances against Belgium, because that'll be the first time perhaps that we see them come up against a very high quality team.
Yeah, and I think that will be the examination of that central defensive partnership at that point in time. But again, it's really hard to know, you know, will Belgium have De Bruyne back by that point or not? Like, there are fitness issues that Belgium have. I think maybe there's a slight advantage that the Italian centre-backs are going to have had a season against Lukaku, so they're going to know him pretty well. It's hard to know. I still feel that Belgium have enough weaknesses at the back, And the slowness of their centre-backs means that Italy will be able to draw them out and probably cause problems through those channels. You know, again, we've seen a lot of teams, if not concede goals, concede opportunities where one of the centre-backs has been dragged out to cover that space, working a nice quick... Finland did it to Russia a couple of times today. You just create that pass on the angle that takes it infield and then back out very quickly and puts a man through. And I think it's really hard describing stuff like that on a podcast, isn't it? Like doing stuff with my hands. I know what I'm trying to convey here. But I think Belgium will be vulnerable to that. That is a particular issue they have, particularly on the right-hand side. The centre-back will step out too far. And I just feel like Italy have got enough in those wide areas to exploit that.
Okay. Well, listen, we'll be back after this. Okay, we're back. And Finland-Russia also happened. Russia won 1-0. My note here, Alex, to you says, get Alex to talk about Alexei Maranchuk.
Yes, Alexei Maranchuk. So Maranchuk is the guy who scores this lovely, lovely goal today against Finland. And I just quickly kudos to Finland, because obviously... very, very difficult circumstances in their last game here. I think they defended really resolutely. They have a nice balance in their midfield with Glenn Kamara and Robin Lodd being a little bit more creative and pushing up. So, I think Finland will not get talked about much other than as an adjunct to that incident. But I think they played really good football today, given the circumstances. Alexei Maranchuk is a lovely, lovely player. He's not even managed 700 minutes in Serie A for Atalanta this season. But if you look at what he does, he's a 6-foot, basically a 10 or a right inside forward, but left-footed. He has a really, really good range of passing. He is a comparable player in terms of creativity, according to FB Ref, to people like Phil Foden. You know, his progressive passing, which is his ability to play passes that go past a number of opposition players and gain a particular distance, is very, very good. And he just exhibits a kind of a creativity and a touch. He's one of these players that Atalanta unearthed from a fairly unprestigious Lokomotiv Moscow in this instance. He's unlucky that he's up against Malinovsky, the Ukraine player who plays in a very similar position for Atalanta. But I think he looks class. When you watch him for Atalanta, he looks fantastic in the clips I've seen. He wears number 59, which I'm slightly un-okay with.
You know, I was thinking that there are probably very few players playing in the world at any one time who can score the goal he scored today. Just because, a couple of reasons. Like, one of the issues in Russian football with the national team at the moment is the kind of the alienation of the attacking midfield. Like Golovin is another one. Cheryshev didn't play today, but you know, and Moranchuk's in that group as a kind of a victim of Zubabul, basically, if such a term exists. And I felt like Rush didn't create many chances, and that was one of those which it fell to him in the box in a situation which you wouldn't even describe as a half chance, really, because of where the defenders were and the position of the goalkeeper. And the transfer of the ball from right foot to left foot was lightning quick, to the point where the defenders couldn't even adjust their body position quickly enough to cut off the angle. And the finish was in the one place that he could have scored from. It's just I don't pretend to learn an awful lot about Moranchuk, but it's just one of those where you think, I know it's a goal, and I know it's just a goal, and it's just a moment, a single game. I also know it's against a not inferior opponent, but not an elite one. But seriously impressive to be able to do those things. It's a speed of thought as well, because in that position, it's not a mechanical action. It's kind of a creative solution to what is quite a complex problem. It's like, how do I get a shot on goal from here? And when a player solves that problem that quickly and that comprehensively, can't help to be impressed by that.
And he also does that with his short passing in and around the edge of the box for Atalanta. Mm-hmm. Because having highlighted him, I watched some clips of him during halftime in the last game, and he does have this ability to dig the ball out under pressure and create something with a little through pass or a little dink that players can run onto. Of course, if you're playing for Russia, even in that slightly withdrawn creative role,
Zubabul.
Right. Zuba's not doing that. So you've got someone who is ideally equipped to play quick little strikers, runs in behind. You know, you think about maybe as a sort of an inside right in a Chelsea side with someone like Werner cutting in and feeding off those little balls, because it's great having a left footer who tucks into that position because of the angles of passing they can open up. But if it's Zuba who's just sort of chugging along, and it feels like a real waste. Russia don't have many other strikers though. So it seems like they're really wedded to this style.
Do you reckon he might be? I mean, I can see a situation where Atalanta play Malinovsky and him in the same formation. I wonder whether he's possibly, I mean, they're slightly different players, but maybe a kind of a long-term successor to Papi Gomez. Wonderful player, but sort of he had an Indian summer at the end of his career, and he's now at Sevilla, and he's still a good player, but he's not a long-term solution for anyone. So I wonder if you can kind of pair him off a centre forward long-term. Malinovsky's slightly more withdrawn. I don't know. That might be too aggressive.
Who
needs strikers?
Don't play with strikers. Just have them alternating, pushing up.
Into kind of rotating false nines. Uber hipsterism.
Absolutely.
Fine. That's kind of the next level of Atalanta, isn't it?
Let's have 2 9.5s. Overlapping centre back.
Speaking of the next level of things, of course, this tournament is a pan-European tournament. We weren't sure that it would be with the old pandemic and everything, but it is a pan-European tournament. And do you know what I've decided, Seb?
Well, you stood up in the middle of the day and just told us you hated it.
I stood up and I said, everyone's attention, please. Yeah. And I turned the TV off during a football match and I said, I don't like it because it's not what I want.
It was a quite petulant moment. But you have a point. Petulant. You do have a point.
My point is that one of the things I've realised and remembered that I like about World Cups and about European Championships is, one, all of the really stupid and cheesy sort of broadcasting adverts and TV titles and intros and all the rest of it, the BBC and ITV and whoever make based around some sort of racial stereotypes of the countries that the tournament is being hosted in. Really fun. I like being able to see all of the different places within a country that I've never been to before, learning a little bit about the country, hearing all of the commentary around the tournament, reflecting the local the culture, or the socioeconomic situation of the country, all the rest of it. All like, I think, you know, one of the things I remember about the 2014 World Cup in Brazil was Brazil. That's one of the things I remember about it. It was exciting and being in the stadium in the middle of the jungle where the massive grasshopper went on James Rodriguez's arm.
Rodriguez, the dinosaur.
That was amazing. That was amazing. And even, you know, like, I don't know. I just think, it feels like the Champions League and I don't like that. I want it to be in one place that I can be excited about that place and imagine being in that place. There are pros to this, of course. And I'm going to let you tell me what they are.
There are. Well, I've got one more con, which is that I quite like when a tournament happens in one country, that tournament has a thing. Like, so 2010, Vuvuzelas in South Africa. 2014, massive bugs and, you know, and interesting stories and, you know, beautiful scenery and amazing new built stadiums in Brazil. And, you know, you go further back and further back. And I think of 2002 in South Korea and Japan, where the kind of the like different type of supporting and the kind of the really affecting enthusiasm for the local fans.
And that the different the time that you had to watch it to. It's one of the night. I mean, I know that's more of a World Cup thing than a Euros thing. But like watching those games, was it South Korea, Japan, what was that, 2002?
Yeah.
I watched the England-Brazil game
where
old Ronaldinho chipped it over David Seaman. I was at school watching that because it was in the morning and we were all in the, I don't know, the whatever you call it, the gym or whatever, all sat on the floor watching it on the big screen or probably on a TV that had been wheeled in, you know, old TV.
We were doing our first year exams at university.
Were you?
There were quite a few people that were, including myself at this point in time, that were coming into exams slightly drunk because because you get up to watch
in the morning, right?
Right, exactly. And then, amazing. Not a good combination.
No.
So there are pros though. And one of them is Pan-European tournament, okay, pandemic aside, because it's a slightly unusual situation, obviously. It was intended as a situation where...
And I don't like the pandemic.
We don't like the pandemic. But Pan-European tournament should afford many more fans the opportunity to go to games.
Yes, this is
true. That's a good thing. Also,
people who could afford a ticket to the game, but not the travel associated with going to a game in another place. And that's a good thing.
Also another good thing. So one of the problems with hosting international tournaments is, of course, the cost of actually building all the infrastructure. Certain countries, Germany, England, probably France, they can hold a tournament with very, very little notice.
Sure.
Other countries are unable to do so because of the economic costs or because they lack the space.
And clearly it's not worth it either.
And it's because it's not worth it because how many white elephant stories do you get after tournaments? So this is a kind of a compromise. A place like, I know it didn't end up hosting any games, but a place like Bilbao, you know, in the Basque Country, that has a chance to host a major tournament game. That is a good thing.
Yes.
And it's a way of spreading that privilege out without asking countries to
spend hundreds of millions of pounds.
Spend hundreds of millions of pounds and sacrifice other things which are probably more important. Spending on healthcare and education and stuff like that, basically.
And for that reason, it's right. It's just a bit placid. As sometimes the right decision often is.
I don't know where we are sometimes. So
we're
watching a game, we turn it on, we're all sat here, and somebody amongst us will say, where's this one happening? Because you don't know, because all the stadiums have kind of been designed to look the same. We're not seeing a lot of the local geography. I don't get a sense of the culture. Some of that is coronavirus, sure. A lot of it is just this kind of, it doesn't really happen anywhere. It's a tournament occurring in the Eurozone.
Yeah.
And it feels weirdly homogenous.
The home advantage thing is just weird.
It is a bit weird, yeah.
Because there's 11 host cities down from 13, right?
Yeah.
And we've seen England play their game at home. Mm-hmm. We've seen Italy play games at home. Who else have we seen play games at home?
Denmark played in Copenhagen.
Did Belgium
Germany
play
in Munich? No, I don't think
Germany
so.
Germany played at home, you're right. Anyway,
Scotland played in Glasgow, obviously.
A number of teams played at home. But not every team will get the opportunity to do that.
No.
I know that at an ordinary World Cup or a Euros where it's hosted in one place, one team seems to have a home advantage. That's still fair, I think.
Hey, Chris says Spain played in Seville. Yes, they did. They played at Betis this round.
Hungary as well.
Hungary, yep. They played in Budapest. So, yes.
It's weird.
It is weird. And I've loved it. But I am glad this is a kind of one-off centenary. I'm aware of the shortcomings and I'm aware of the faults and the flaws and the bidding processes and, you know, the staging of tournaments. I completely accept all of those issues. It's just that I like the traditional format a bit more.
Yeah.
I don't like people flying around lots.
There is this sort of the environmental factor, I suppose.
Well, I think there's...
Although, to be honest, in most countries that have hosted a big major tournament recently, Russia, Brazil, you're probably doing about as much flying as they are in Europe. It's about the same distance.
Which is also really bad.
World Cup is going to be in Canada and the United States and Mexico before too long. Is Canada and the United States, or Canada, United States and Mexico?
And Mexico. Yeah, it's all three.
So that's going to be a huge amount of...
I think football has a real responsibility to address its carbon footprint, particularly with regards to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that there are good arguments in favor of spreading tournaments around like this. And I think allowing groups of fans who maybe otherwise wouldn't get to see it, that's great. I understand the democratization of football in that way. But I also think that, you know, as we did the video on climate change and football is going to be really, really badly affected by climate change. And that, and also the high levels of polyester in football shirts and the lack of sustainability there. You know, football is contributing to climate change and it's doing very little to offset
that. Yeah, for sure. Also, that democratization of football, it's a little bit of a flawed argument because, yes, you can stage a game in a country, but if the ticket prices are three times the price of a local wage...
The corporate side of it is always bad. And obviously there are issues with, you know, how the process of awarding goes and the nature of some of the host venues. Yeah, but that's very political.
We did a video on climate change. Where could you see that, Joe?
Trying to piggyback off the back of climate change for our own benefit doesn't feel like right thing.
No,
after a conversation with lots of nuance where we talked about what's right and wrong, to try to profit commercially off the back of climate change is not the route here, Seb. It's not the route.
If you were interested,
moving on.
If you were interested, though, if someone wanted to learn more,
you already said it. No one's listening to this that doesn't know where.
I'll tweet the
it.
Video link out anyway.
Sure, let's all profit from climate. In fact, that's what they say about climate change, isn't it?
Did we not demonetize that video?
I don't think so. The way I'm sure it's being sponsored by Gazprom as well. The way that you. Combat climate change, as they say in a sort of capitalistic world, is to make money. That's the only way that you can save the planet. But anyway, let's move on to Sergio Ramos leaving Real Madrid. An even bigger story, an earthquake in football, bigger than all of climate change. And I'm going to go and get the wall chart while you talk about Sergio Ramos leaving.
Feels seismic, doesn't it? Are you actually going to walk? Yes, you are going to do that.
Yes, I am.
It feels, I can't imagine Real Madrid without either Sergio Ramos playing or lurking in the stands or being around it somehow or being associated with it. It feels like a very strange situation when you might have a Clasico in which there is no possibility of a Sergio Ramos red card. That feels quite odd. No, because Joe's gone, you're actually going to have to take part in this.
He's just walked off.
I can't just monologue about Sergio Ramos.
Oh, okay. I thought that's what
you were
saying.
Because I can't swear. We're doing this live. And there are words that I've used to describe him, which are not acceptable.
Well, it's the end of an era, isn't it?
The thing about him is it's the end of an era, and it feels like the right time for him to be leaving. At the same time, I could probably make a good argument for him going to at least six top-rate European teams. And being,
he's still incredibly good.
He's still a really good player.
And I do worry. I mean, I don't worry because I'm not a Real Madrid fan, so I don't really care. But I would have concerns for that club that there is the good spine of that team who have been there a while and will provide leadership and so on. It's Modric. It's
Christ.
You know, Varane has been there a long time and is a good player, but Varane
is staying. We don't know about
if he's staying, which he may not be. And Varane is a very quiet player. Yeah. You know, he's hugely experienced and he's played at the highest level for a long time and internationally with France and so on. But he's not exactly the kind of muscular, shouty leader that Sergio Ramos is. Thibaut Courtois, again, long-term presence in that dressing room.
Benzema.
Benzema's not loud. Benzema's too cool.
Like Benzema has the aura of a captain, though, potentially.
Yeah, possibly. But again, I don't see that degree of arrogance, actually. I think, you know, sometimes when we talk about sports people, arrogance can be good, right? And definitely. Sergio Ramos, if you're a Real Madrid player or fan, his arrogance is a good thing. It's a, we are going to win this game, whoever we're against, whatever, because we're Real Madrid and I'm Sergio Ramos and I don't give up, you know.
Well, also, he's
they've got no one like that now.
But that arrogance is justified because he's associated with so much success.
Oh, completely.
So like there's a difference between your arrogant player that has a lot of self-belief and it's all completely unfounded versus your
Let's have some examples of that.
Why don't we go to Joe for his wall chart?
Yay.
And then we'll come back to me for those.
No. I've got the chart, gang.
Craig Bellamy.
Also, it's time to go home in a minute, isn't it? It's quite late now. And the reason I got the chart is because I didn't take notes earlier, as Seb suggested, but I couldn't remember.
You said you would keep notes in your head.
I said I'd remember, but I can't remember. Anyway, the thing that made me think this is a bit mad is the Netherlands, because the Netherlands are in Group C, right? The Netherlands are in the group with Austria, North Macedonia and Ukraine. Now, Group C will play, I think, some games tomorrow.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes,
yeah?
That's right.
Yeah. So we'll be talking about this as well tomorrow. But currently at the top of the group, having beaten Ukraine, Austria, I suppose. Oh, maybe Austria top of the group on goal difference. Whatever. The point is that the Netherlands are potentially, based on their performance, perhaps likely to win that group. I mean, the consensus in the room earlier was that Ukraine is still a good team to finish second. If they were to win their group, as expected, Group C, the first place team in Group C plays in round of 16 game number 3 against the third team from Groups D, E or F. So there's a small chance here that they could draw a Portugal or a Germany from Group F, but more likely they will face a team, perhaps Poland, perhaps Slovakia, perhaps Czech Republic, perhaps Scotland, right? You feel like the Netherlands could win any of those games, okay? In which case, the winner of of Game 3 goes into the quarterfinals to play the winner of Game 1. This is quite long.
You've got lost.
Point is, that is second place from Group A or Group B, which is very likely to be, at this time, Wales or maybe Russia or Denmark, right? That is also a winnable game,
yeah.
Which then takes you to the semi-finals before they face a team that you don't think that they will definitely win. That's the easiest route, as far as I can work out, to the semi-finals for every... It doesn't feel right to me. And I know England had an easy route in the World Cup, right? And there's always a team that has an easy route. I think might be the Netherlands.
I'd say...
I'm not angry about it.
There's a difference, though. I mean, England played Colombia in the last of 16 and, you know, competent... You know, England didn't play minnows outside of the group stage. Panama, yes, of course, but... they beat teams they should beat, absolutely. But it's different. And this is kind of, it's something we talked about last night, which was, this is the cost of expanding tournaments. Because if you...
Who did they play in the round of 16? Was it Sweden?
No, Colombia, and then Sweden in the quarterfinals.
Sweden in the quarterfinals.
And then, you know, Croatia in the semis.
But also, we were looking at this earlier, and England's side of the draw was extravagantly easier than the other side of the draw.
No, I agree. It's just that at any one time in Europe, you're going to have, what, maybe 5 or 6 really top class, if that... 5 or 6 very good teams, probably 2 or 3 top class ones. If you want to have a round of 16 in a European Championship, you are going to get this because there isn't really an effective way of evening it out without some kind of slightly artificial seeding system. I don't know how that would work for a knockout round, really, whereby you're going to have games which allow inferior teams to get through. And you can argue that both ways. Either it's not what you want to see as a neutral, or you give chances to teams that otherwise in previous generations wouldn't have got that far to go deep into tournaments, play one-off games against really good sides and perhaps cause a shock. Have another Greece, maybe. I don't know.
But sure.
It's
in this case, though, it feels like we would see that for the Netherlands. And I have nothing against the Netherlands, but they are a team I've seen go that deep in a tournament before. I suppose if I thought it was Ukraine that would go that far, I think maybe that'd be kind of exciting.
That would be more interesting.
Feels a bit unfair to the Netherlands now, doesn't it, that I'm saying this?
I feel like the strength of the European Championship used to be 16 teams, all pretty good, very few easy games, and that was great. Like, I'm all for more football in a tournament. It's kind of rare to find me making an argument against that, but I just feel like making tournaments bigger all the time, big expansion, this is where it leaves you. Lack of jeopardy and games that, not that you don't care about, but they don't they don't speak to you in the same way as, say, like Germany, France did to all of us last night.
Sure.
That's the difference, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, there's a comment in the chat, someone saying the tournament is all set up for the big teams. I think it's quite the opposite. I think Belgium and Italy, if they do as expected, they will meet in the quarterfinals, right? Which means only one of those teams will go beyond that stage. Mm-hmm. We see the split across A to C versus D to F. There are meetings when you get to the quarters and the semis, but mostly it's stuck to those sides. On the A to B side, we have Belgium and we have Italy, who are the two standout teams. And that's top tier over there. The Netherlands, we weren't sure of before the tournament began. On the other side, we have England, we have Croatia, we have Spain, we have France, we have Portugal, we have Germany. It feels heavily stacked on one side. Yeah. Many of these teams will be eliminated before we even get to face teams from the other side of the bracket. I don't think it is set up for the big time. And in a way, that's quite exciting and that's kind of cool. I guess it's just a problem with tournament football, isn't it? That it's not a league. You don't get to see every team against every team. It's, you know, different routes are lucky or unlucky based on where you're drawn, and that's kind of how it all works.
Yeah, it's just random, isn't it? It's not like it matters.
Well, there we go. It doesn't matter. Thank you for listening to the TIFO podcast this evening. We'll be back tomorrow with whatever games are happening then. Until then, Seb Stafford-Ball, thank you.
Thank you, Joe Devine.
Alex Stewart, thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
And thanks, of course, to Don and Sol, our healthy production crew for this evening. A little wave there from Don. There's Don's hand. We'll be joined again tomorrow by JJ, I believe. We'll have Alex back for the weekend. And have a lovely Thursday. Wednesday. Have a lovely week. Goodbye.